We are making the 80th anniversary of the exodus of Polish refugees from their land by the USSR. I should once again thank the Iranian nation who has hosted our countrymen, providing a safe haven for them for decades.
The Polish foreign minister underlined the significance of the 2015 deal in bringing peace, calling on both Iranian and American officials to arrive at an agreement as soon as possible.
Poland and Iran are looking forward to the success of the negotiations over the 2015 deal. When that happens, we will start extensive economic cooperation with Iran without worries over the sanctions.
Poland sits on a geostrategically important part of Eastern Europe. It could act as a gateway for Iran to trade with other European states. Iran, for its part, can also act as a gateway for Polish trade with the Middle East. The two sides cited lack of knowledge as the main reason behind their low trade, hoping that this trip will set the start for broader economic ties.
After decades of uneventful relations, Tehran and Warsaw are now determined to begin a new chapter in their ties. And this last visit by the Polish foreign minister is seen as the first step towards stronger ties between the two countries, something which could redefine the course of many unresolved issues, from the fate of the 2015 deal to Iran's ties with the West. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rohingya refugees in India are in a desperate situation following renewed detention and deportation campaigns from the administration. Schools have already been detained while some deported. Intense crackdown on the community has created fear, which has led to sleepless nights amid worries of night raids and family separations. This old man, a little familiar with the local language, says, "I don't go out of the camp and prefer dying here than in a detention camp." Thousands of Rohingya refugees in India are living in an appalling situation with little or no help from anyone. Even the UN refugee agency is watching as a silent spectator, they said. Their men were involved in menial work for survival. However, due to detention fear, they had no choice but to abandon work and stick together in their camps.
Finding this camp wasn't easy. And upon reaching here, panic and horror was visible on every face. They got terrified upon seeing us and rushed to hidings, saying media in India is portraying their image very negatively, and this has made their survival even harder. According to rights activists, refugee crises across the world are alarming, but this particular community continues to be an unseen victim of immeasurable extents of violence. Based on official estimates, more than 40,000 Rohingya refugees are living in parts of India after fleeing a brutal crackdown against their community in Myanmar. Many refugees say they felt safe in India since they arrived, but over the last few years, a vicious hate campaign and their expulsion is haunting the community.
We appeal to the UN. We have no support. We need your help and the help from the Indian government to stay alive. We are in acute pain and distress. We reached here just with our lives intact. Please do not detain us, deport us, or separate us from families. Rather, kill us. We have no strength to face more.
Activists say the need of the hour is to protect the rights of these refugees and secure their survival rather than deliberately targeting them and deporting them, despite the fact their lives are under threat back in Myanmar. Rights activists have urged the Indian government to formulate a uniform refugee policy. Since the country has no refugee law, they urge the Indian government to treat refugees equally, regardless of caste, ethnicity or faith. Munawar Zaman in the outskirts of New Delhi.
NATO's hopes of securing two new additions to its military alliance are close to becoming reality, as the historically neutral Nordic countries, Sweden and Finland, take serious steps towards applying for membership. The Scandinavian powers' interest in joining spiked after Russia's military operation in Ukraine began. Just the idea of a NATO expansion northwards has sparked a furious Russian response.
Both the US and NATO have made abundantly clear that they are very keen to see the two new Nordic additions to the bloc. However, with Sweden and Finland's long history of neutrality seeming to serve them very well until now, is joining the military alliance truly beneficial to their national and regional security?
NATO members, including the UK, US, France and Germany, have been applying pressure to secure the two additions. Moscow has repeatedly warned of serious consequences if Finland and Sweden join NATO, saying it would strengthen its land, naval and air forces in the Baltic Sea, and even raise the possibility of deploying nuclear weapons in the area.
But what NATO is doing is to pull increasing numbers of countries within its orbit, either as direct members or as associate members, and that this then ties them to a whole number of things which they may not want to do in the future. The consequences of the end of this neutrality will not be more safety for any country in Eastern Europe. It will be an increase in the arms race on both sides. It will be an increase in military presence in those countries and elsewhere. So this is a road that people should think very, very carefully before they go down.
The coming days are crucial. Finland will decide to apply for membership by May the 12th, while Sweden, the less enthusiastic of the two, is conducting a security policy review, including the pros and cons of joining the alliance. The results are due on May the 13th. If both decide yes, the process of joining will be swift, but so too could Russia's response. Robert Carter, Stockholm.
Two Palestinians have carried out a retaliatory operation in the central Israeli city of Eilat, where several casualties were reported. The operation came hours after Israeli forces attacked Palestinian worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque to make way for hundreds of settlers to enter the holy site in Al-Quds. Over a dozen Palestinians were injured and many more arrested in the raid on Thursday. The retaliation also coincides with the Nakba, the anniversary of the illegal creation of Israel. Palestinian resistance movements have praised the operation as a natural response to Israeli crimes.
Operation Eilat is part of the public display of our people's anger at the invasion of our sanctuaries by the occupiers. Today's operation goes in line with the resistance's warning that the Al-Aqsa Mosque is a red line.
We hail the successful and heroic operation in occupied Al-Quds and remind Israel that our people will respond to the regime's crimes.
President Mahmoud Abbas, however, condemned the operation and warned against the Israelis making this incident a pretext to target the Palestinians. The operation comes against the backdrop of the regime's intensified acts of violence across the occupied West Bank, including targeting Muslim worshippers at Al-Aqsa. Over the past weeks, tensions have been running high at the mosque compound due to incursions by Israeli settlers protected by regime forces. Hundreds of Palestinians have been injured in the latest attacks. Dozens have been arrested.
An occupying force continuously trample on the rights of a subjugated people, trample on their religious beliefs, wipe their feet on sacred shrines, and expect that this people will simply lay down and continue to take it without responding.
As a consequence of Israel's atrocities, the Palestinians have ramped up retaliatory attacks in Israeli cities. An Israeli minister has said the regime suffered a very heavy price in the Eilat operation. And now Israel has once again revved up its crackdown machine against the Palestinians through arresting dozens of people and closing the crossings to the West Bank and the besieged Gaza Strip, actions that will undoubtedly escalate the already tense circumstances in the occupied territories.
Casting their ballots before heading out to work. Britons having their say in an election that'll send thousands of representatives, conservative, labor, or liberal Democrat, to local councils.
This election, though, is not just about bin collections, access to hospitals and libraries, or the state of the roads. The fallout from the Partygate scandal and the cost of living crisis is looming large.
Prime Minister Boris Johnson has apologized for COVID lockdown violations on his watch and acknowledged his government could do more to ease the blow to the public purse from soaring prices. But many, among them his party members, still want him gone, with a recent survey predicting heavy losses for the Conservatives.
Partygate is a big thing. I mean, Boris just lied through his teeth, and I find it really disgusting the way he's behaved, actually.
It's mostly down to the Conservatives, Boris Johnson over-promising, under-delivering, lying his way through. I mean, the recent Ukrainian refugees and Afghan refugees, where they promised to do so much and haven't done anything at all.
He has very little credibility. I mean, he's lied to Parliament, he's lied to the nation.
Main challenger Labour have been consistently leading in national polls for the past few months, but that might not translate into gains. Whether it's down to Brexit, COVID, or personality, Labour's new leader, Keir Starmer, is yet to reconnect with a large part of the country that deserted his party and voted Conservative in the 2019 general election.
They may make some gains, but I think that will be in spite of Sir Keir Starmer rather than because of him. And I think it really will be a reaction to the very poor way in which the Conservative government has actually been leading the country.
It won't be long before the results come out. And if the predictions turn out to have been right, then experts say it might be curtains for the Prime Minister. Saeed Porza, London.
It was March 31st when the Italian government put an end to a 2-year state of emergency due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Just over a month later, some Italian media are reporting that the Mario Draghi government is mulling over issuing a new state of emergency linked this time to the ongoing conflict in Ukraine. Some newspapers have even suggested that Draghi is considering postponing next year's general elections. The Ukraine war and the subsequent sanctions imposed on Moscow, in addition to Rome's decision to significantly cut off its supply of Russian gas, have had a ferocious impact on Italy's already struggling economy.
A government of common sense always works on dealing with more than just one scenario. Suggesting the adoption of war economy and new lockdowns is very much premature. I'd rather focus on diversifying Italy's energy supply sources and tackling unemployment, which is likely to soar significantly in autumn.
The National Association of Entrepreneurs, Confindustria, has recently said Italy's economy is heading for recession, which is defined by 2 consecutive quarters of GDP negative growth. Last month, the Italian government revised down its 2022 economic growth forecast to 3.1% from a 4.7% projection made last September, a forecast considered optimistic by most independent bodies. Economists have warned that surging food and energy prices will seriously affect Italians' spending power, leading to an excruciating decline in domestic demand. It is also estimated that 500,000 workers are expected to lose their job should Italy completely halt its gas supplies from Russia.
Giving up the Russian supplies will be a catastrophe for the European manufacturer, and for Italy this would be managed only through a profound alteration of the democratic rules.
Last year, Italy had recorded a strong recovery from its economic contraction of nearly 9% in 2020 due to the restrictions adopted to counter the COVID crisis. That recovery has been cancelled by the measures undertaken to sanction Russia over the conflict in Ukraine. Max Civili, Rome.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند
و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد میشید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Salam and welcome to the program. If you remember, we discussed Imam Khomeini's recommendations on political groups, especially MKO terrorist organization, and said that he had advised all terrorist groups to return back to the ocean of the Iranian nation and stop acts of terror to satisfy their masters in the West or the East. In this episode, we are going to touch upon his stance on leftist and separatist groups. Stay tuned, please. Concurrent with the victory of the Russian Revolution of 1917 and coming to power of communist ideology in the country, leftist thoughts grew in many countries, particularly in the neighbors of Soviet Union, including Iran. Though the religious fabric of Iran and the sensitivity of the ruling system never led them to spread much among masses. Tudeh Party was the most important organized group among the leftist groups which came to existence in Iran after the Second World War. This party was eradicated in two phases. First, after the assassination attempt against the Shah in Tehran University, and then in the post-1953 coup period. Thus, its leaders and advocates escaped or were tortured or executed. A few of them also turned into spies of the regime through the pressures and temptations of the Shah agents. In 1960s, due to the increase of partisan struggles inspired by the thoughts of Che Guevara, Mao and Castro, and closure of political climate in Iran, some youth and students started armed struggles against the Shah. They intended to spread armed and partisan struggles to the whole society, a la China and Cuba, to topple the regime. But the Shah regime was fully supported by the U.S. As a result, the members of such groups would soon be identified and repressed before taking any serious measure. These groups were totally destroyed in late 1960s and early 1970s. At that time, the regime of Mohammad Reza Pahlavi was in its most powerful days, thanks to the exorbitant oil revenues and relying on security and military support of the U.S. and allies. In such circumstances, Imam Khomeini started his struggle against the Shah and the U.S. with trust in God and relying on people's all-out support. Millions of men and women from all walks of life answered positively to Imam Khomeini's call to show their opposition to the regime of Shah. Therefore, they poured to the streets and chanted anti-regime slogans. The Imam's all-encompassing umbrella had indeed covered all political parties and every social stratum. Thus, the Islamic Revolution triumphed in a few months to the bewilderment of all analysts. Without doubt, the key element in this victory was the unmatched personality of Imam Khomeini and his charismatic leadership. The course of the revolution left no choice for political parties but to join the masses, even if they didn't believe in the ideology and ideals of the Imam and the people. This was the means for most of them to survive. The leftist groups had no belief in Islam, but had to join the people to survive. However, after the victory, they started to act as opposition and counter-revolutionary elements. They left no stone unturned to hurt the Islamic revolution. Imam Khomeini time and again advised them to return to the Islamic revolution and the Iranian nation. But they insisted on their stubborn thoughts and were finally exterminated. The Imam writes in his testament, "My recommendation to the leftists, like communists and Fadaye Khalq partisans and other groups with leftist tendencies, is that without proper studying of ideologies and the ideology of Islam, with those who are well aware of ideologies, especially Islam, which motive has satisfied you to be inclined to the ideology that has failed in the world today, and what has happened that you have become content with few isms whose content is null with researches? What has motivated you to intend to draw your country to the lap of the Soviet or China and to fight your nation in the name of love of two-day party or hatch plots to the benefit of foreigners against your country and oppressed masses?" Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, addressing leftist groups, writes in his testament, "You can see that since the onset of communism, its masqueraders have been the most dictatorial, the most power-seeking, and the most monopolist governments in the world. What nations were smashed and annihilated under the rule of the Soviet, claiming to support masses? The Russian nation, Muslims and non-Muslims, have been struggling with twitches under the pressure of the Communist Party and are denied any freedom and are living in suffocation worse than that of the world dictators. Stalin, who was one of the so-called bright figures of the party, we were witness to his coming and going and his protocols and aristocracy. Now that you, the Beagle, are sacrificing your life for that regime, the oppressed people of the Soviet and its satellites like Afghanistan are dying of their oppressions." Imam Khomeini continues to advise the leftists, "You who are claiming the advocacy of people, what crimes you have committed against these people wherever you could, as with the noble people of Amul, who you wrongly called your strong advocates and sent many of them deceptively to fight people and the government to be killed. You want to offer the Iranian oppressed and deprived nation to the Soviet dictatorship, and you are doing this treason under the guise of Fadaye Khalq and advocates of the deprived. The Tudeh Party and its cohorts are doing this through conspiracy under the mask of supporting the Islamic Republic, while other groups are doing it through arms, terror, and blasts." Imam Khomeini writes in continuation, "I write as testament to you, parties and groups, either those who are known as leftists or those who are feeding from and inspired by the West, or even those such as Democratic or Komolé parties who take arms in the name of autonomy and advocacy of Kurds and Baluch, and have destroyed the deprived people of Kurdistan and other places, and prevent cultural hygiene and economic services and reconstruction by the government on those provinces to join the nation. Now that they have experienced that they have done nothing and can't do anything but making the inhabitants miserable, so it is to their benefit and that of the nations and regions to assist the government and give up rebellion, serving the foreigners and betrayal of their country. They should embark on building the country and be sure that Islam is better for them than both the criminal Western Pole and the dictatorial Eastern Pole, and it will fulfill the humane wishes of people better.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
When it comes to the conflict in Ukraine, the Russian president has said that Russia's military operation was a preemptive move against future aggression. Sentiments were received warmly in the Russian capital at the Victory Day parade, but not in Ukraine, where fighting is raging, and not in the U.S., who is keen on keeping this war going. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the different dynamics involved in this war and where the future stands, especially the world economic standing. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Joining us, activist and commentator Don DeBar, joins us from Westchester, New York, and we also have lawyer, writer, historian, and former UN Special Rapporteur Alfred de Zayas, who joins us from Geneva.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Alfred de Zayas, let me first start with you. We're looking at Russia's military operation in Ukraine. Basically, the way that the Russian President Vladimir Putin described it today, of which there were many descriptions in his view of why this special military operation happened, it was a preemptive move against what he called future aggression. He capitalized on that and said that Russia had to act, and I'm quoting him, because a large-scale offensive against the breakaway republics in the eastern Donbass region was being planned. Are you convinced by Vladimir Putin's explanation there?
Well, this information has been in the public domain already several weeks. We do know that Zelensky was committed to retake the Donbas by force, and evidently there was also a decision to attack sooner or later Crimea. Now, as a professor of international law and as a former rapporteur, I devoted one of my reports to the General Assembly on the right of self-determination of peoples. And I think it should be the function of the United Nations to conduct self-determination referenda in all countries where there is conflict. As a matter of fact, the realization of self-determination is a conflict prevention measure. And the war didn't start on the 24th of February 2022. You know as well as I do that the war started on the 22nd of February 2014, 8 years ago, at the coup d'etat against the democratically elected president of Ukraine, Yanukovych. And there, of course, the West, NATO countries, the United States, my country of nationality, were deeply involved in the organization and in the financing of that coup d'etat. So you have here a problem of internationalization of this dispute. You have Ukraine being armed to the teeth since 2014, not since January or February 2022. So the resilience of the Ukrainian army and the fact that they have survived this long is a direct consequence of the enormous armaments that my country, the United States and the United Kingdom and other NATO countries have delivered to the Ukraine, and the logistical support, the intelligence support that has been given.
Okay, could I jump in and just make sure we understand you correctly here? Since you're saying that this is something that broke out in 2014, are we to conclude from what you just said there that you're saying that it's not, as you said, something that has happened since January in terms of arming Ukraine, but it has happened since 2014 up to this point, that has continued, which is why they were able to hold out? Is that what you're saying?
People say, well, you know, Putin is unsuccessful. He is failing in his attempt to overwhelm Ukraine. Well, he never intended to overwhelm Ukraine. He intended to render Ukraine no longer a military danger. That's why he's focused primarily on destroying the military targets, the railroads.
Let me jump in then and bring Don DeBar. And Don DeBar, I'm mentioning what Putin said because he's explaining himself, and I think it's worth mentioning. And another quote by him, we saw the military infrastructure unfolding in Ukraine, hundreds of foreign advisors starting their work. There were regular deliveries of the most modern weapons from NATO countries. The danger grew
right.
every day.
You know, let's get an idea of the scale of what we're talking about. And first of all, you know, I would venture to say that perhaps the war began even before 2014. Certainly the preparations for the coup that took place over a few years prior to that were part of the same war. Planning is part of the war. It's also a war crime to plan a war, particularly one that's actualized. But I would say going back to the first time they crossed the Elbe with NATO after promising, in order to induce Russia to be the only of the four powers to abandon its occupation of Germany, even though it was the most horribly damaged party in the world, more horribly damaged than the United States, Britain, and France combined, and also in terms of body count, including the Jews that the Nazis killed. The Soviet Union lost almost 30 million people, okay? And people quibble over 6 million people or not in the Holocaust. Granting 6 million, that's five times as many people. The United States lost in the six figures numbers, okay? And so the Soviet Union abandoned its occupation of Germany on a promise that NATO would not fill that space up and come forward. And they are now at the borders of Russia inside the Soviet Union. They have the three Baltics. They have half of Ukraine. And just for a little scale here. The aid, quote unquote, the military assets that are being transferred to Ukraine just in the first 7 months of this year, what's being budgeted, the $33 million and the billion or the $13 or $14 billion that have been handed over, annualize out to about $80 billion. Russia's entire annual military budget is $65 billion for 2021. So we and also Germany and Britain and France and Italy are sending arms to Ukraine as well. That's on top of the numbers I just cited. So in terms of the scale of the threat that President Putin is referring to in terms of military infrastructure being set up, we're talking about something massive. And this is in the one area, the European theater of Russia. Their $65 billion also is part of their defense in the Eastern theater in Asia.
Well, Don DeBar, so again, great facts that you're stating here. Obviously, I'm guessing the NATO member countries, and in particular the U.S., they're all aware of this, but the general public is not. And, of course, the long-term memory perhaps doesn't serve the whole world, which conveniently, I guess, they have shut down Russia's, for example, RT in particular, who obviously wants these types of facts to go out. And, of course, our station also, as we're broadcasting what you have said. So that becomes an information war in a sense. But what's amazing about this is that Putin is being demonized, Alfred Desaias, in the way that he is, because he has been called a war criminal. He has been called by the U.S. President Joe Biden. And I forgot the other way that he was...
Steinmeier, by the German president also.
Right. So is that something that... I mean, I'm not trying to promote violence nor deaths or civilians being targeted. So putting that aside, is it correct to put him in that context as the U.S. president has?
Well, demonization of a rival is, of course, primarily for local consumption, since the United States and NATO are aggressors in so many countries. In order to sell it to the public, we are nominally a democratic country, and you have to indoctrinate people in hating the enemy. So we have unilaterally declared Russia and China to be our enemies, and as in George Orwell's 1984, there's something called hate week. Hate week is an exercise in hate. And that is organized and conducted by the government and by the government's proxies. And that is what we have been doing for many, many years. We have a problem here of having brainwashed a large swathe of the American public into hating Russia, into canceling Russian culture, canceling Anna Netrebko and... Valery Gergiev and canceling, Tchaikovsky concerts and all sorts of things. This is like in 2003 when we canceled the French and when we rebaptized French fries, freedom fries, etc. It's an enormous machinery of propaganda, and this information war actually works. The majority of the American population doesn't think like I do, or doesn't think like John Mearsheimer does, or like Stephen Kinzer does, or like Francis Boyle, or Dan Kovalik thinks, or Marjorie Cohn. The American public tends to think my country right or wrong, and we are by definition the good guys, and we have a mission to bring democracy to Russia, not only to the Ukraine. We want regime change in Russia.
That was my next question. I'm glad you brought that up because, they say that Biden, it was a slip, and they had to come and clean that up, so to speak, the damage that caused. But isn't that the ultimate intention, Don DeBar, when it comes to the U.S. intentions in Russia? Of course, they're going at it in terms of the economic strangulation as much as they can. At the same time, of course, militarily, they're trying to bring the Russian military to its knees. But ultimately, do you think that's their goal?
Well, that's been the goal since 1917. That's the longest running and most expensive project in human history that has been regime change in Russia, in the Soviet Union, from what Churchill, you know, vowing that or is reporting that that Bolshevik baby needed to be suffocated in its crib, to the $1 trillion military, you know, spending, you know, I don't know, $10 trillion, $50 trillion between 1945 and last Tuesday, all geared to dominate Russia and China, to remove the impediments to the utilization by the people that own the United States and Europe and everything else that they can put their hands on, to have access to the resources, the mineral resources and the human resources, without another rival on the planet. That is their objective. They're very clear about it. Brzezinski was clear about it. He wrote about it. He said it on tape a million times. Kissinger, a lot lessers, including some of the clowns they have in power now. This past week, five or six that I saw on tape say, of members of Congress, said, we are at war with Russia. They say that we are now. Biden says regime change. Some others have said that, too, a little more credible. And if that's true, first of all, I'm in the middle of working on, we've been trying to organize people to write something to their member of Congress to say, make Biden stop or impeach him. We can't have a war with Russia. Nobody's interested in that. But the problem we have is this. I remember in 2018 when the shrink who used to be at Yale, who got fired for these kinds of antics, there were three or four or five, it ended up being 700 psychiatrists that signed a letter expressing their fear of Donald Trump because he was unhinged. And this was because of a phone call, a nighttime tweet that he made, making reference to North Korea, saying to Kim Jong-un, you know, yeah, you've got a button, but I've got a bigger one and mine works. They thought he was unhinged. This was an unnecessary risk of nuclear war. This guy here, who can't remember whether or not he put on pants, literally, you can see how addled he is, right, has us at Russia's border at war with Russia, pumping in as much money and equipment as Russia spends on its own.
Right. Well, let me ask you this, Alfred Desaias, because Alfred Desaias, when you see the amount of energy, money, backing, support that comes through the military door, not only by the U.S., but also by the NATO member countries, which many analysts say it's the pressure from the U.S. that is making them do that, because on the side, you have military manufacturers that are jumping up and down, obviously looking at their ticker, on Wall Street, seeing how much money is being made. But yet, when it comes to diplomacy, silence. As a former U.N. Special Rapporteur, what does that mean? How does that make you feel?
Well, it's clear that our geopolitical interest is full spectrum dominance. That's what we want. And we have to sell it to the American people. That we do through propaganda and double standards. But what's interesting is that we can make a 20-year war in Afghanistan, United States, United Kingdom, NATO countries, completely fail in obtaining what we claimed that we wanted. But of course, the military-industrial complex laughed all the way down to the back. Yep. I mean, it's the military-industrial complex that rules the United States. It is what you might call the deep state that is behind this war, and that is what prevents Zelensky from reaching a diplomatic solution, because he could have had a diplomatic solution in January, in February, in the first days of the war, and there have been negotiations nonstop with the Ukrainians and the Russians, and the solution was simply neutrality and no membership in NATO, and no further threatening with major, you know, missiles and heavy weapons next to the border of the Donbas and next to the border of Russia. That's what it's about. But of course, we in the United States don't get this information. You can get it in the internet if you proactively look for it.
Sure,
you would
sure.
have to look for it.
I have to ask you this, Don DeBar. It's a little bit outdated, but I'm really curious as to what your thoughts are when you either read, heard, or saw the U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi going to Ukraine. I mean, she could have done a Skype. What was the reason behind her being there, other than the fact that, and this is just an opinion here, to make sure to give the support that Zelensky, I'm not too sure, was looking for from Nancy Pelosi, but to endorse the fact that he should keep on going with the war. God forbid that he might have thoughts about wanting to resolve this.
Yeah, I mean, all I can do is speculate also, of course. But I mean, first of all, a deduction that I've made, that's all it is. But if you do a close review of every visit by people, you know, administration, congressional representatives, European officials, et cetera, to quote Kiev since the 26th or 27th of February, you're going to find out that you don't see a single active street scene without the, debris of a matting, you know, of a superimposed figure. My theory is that Zelensky left Kiev around the 26th of February, along with, I know for a fact it was reported that both the NATO headquarters that was in Kiev and also the U.S. Embassy staff left. They went first to Lvov, or Lviv, as they call it now, and then to Warsaw within like 3-4 days. My theory is that Zelensky also went, and he's been there since then. If you look back at around the negotiations for the first meeting with the Russians, he insisted that it be in Warsaw. The Russians were willing to meet in Ukraine over the border from Belarus. And so I think that he's there. So the answer to your question would be, I think one of the objectives of sending Pelosi there is to provide the illusion that Zelensky hasn't left Ukraine. I think he has. And I think that that's something that people need to consider.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, since we're running quickly out of time here, Alfred Zayas, so you have the U.S. Close to $4 billion, if not a little bit more, just during the Biden presidency, looking for the $30 billion, which $20 billion will be the military assistance. And, of course, you have all the rest of the EU member states that have provided the military assistance on top of the sanctions. But then you have the news that comes out that says the ruble has become the best performing currency. Or when you have 10 EU countries that are quietly buying Russian gas, oil, of course, that could be replaced. At the same time, you have record sales coming through because of the high price of gas for Russia. They are not obviously getting the results that they wanted with these sanctions, and of course with all that military assistance. So doesn't that show that that's not going to work? That the Russia's money wheel is going to keep turning because obviously the sanctions have not had the impact, the intended impact that they wanted.
Well, I'm not even sure that they intended that. I mean, we live in a make-believe world. We know that sanctions do not work. Sanctions against Cuba have not worked in 61 years. Sanctions against Nicaragua in 42. Sanctions against Venezuela in 22 years. They have not induced a regime change. But we have to somehow show that we are strong and that we are defending our values and that we have a mission to bring democracy to Russia. And the forced sanctions, even if it leads to serial bankruptcies in Germany, in France, in the United Kingdom, it is the German businessman, it is the German industrialist who's losing money and tons of it because of these sanctions. The whole thing is sick. But again, you remember in Orwell's 1984, you have newspeak and you have doublethink and you have cognitive dissonance. Uh-huh. And you can believe at the same time that the sanctions will have some effect, even though empirically, they're going to hurt you more than Russia.
Well, this is the part that is very confusing. Don DeBar, maybe you can clarify it for us. What would a win look like for either side, actually? What would winning look like for the U.S.? when it comes to what it wants, because it can't, obviously, based on just too many analysis that's been made, be able to push the Russian forces out of Ukraine. I mean, I'm looking at some of the stats here, 900,000 active personnel and 2 million reservists that Russia has, and also these are the favorable positions that it has in the east along with the air power. So what would a win look like for the U.S.? And at the same time, let's not leave Russia out of this. You know, what would a win for Russia look like? Because reports indicate that they have suffered massively when it comes to soldiers' lives and also equipment.
First of all, I don't believe the reports that are from here that they've had massive losses. But whatever that it is. I'll answer about Russia first because it's short. It's a shorter answer. A win for Russia is a basically a pushback of the threat, the immediate threat to their security. That would be a withdrawal. I mean, they've been clear about what they want, a withdrawal of NATO forces. It really should go back to the other side of the Elbe River in Germany. But certainly the border countries should be neutralized, sort of a Finlandization, as the term is used now by some who hold themselves out as historians. And the abatement of the threat. For the United States, their goal, their objective is regime change in Russia. President Putin made clear that there will be no regime change in Russia, having nothing to do with his personal presidency, but the Russian government was elected by the Russian people. They will choose their own form of government, and they have the weapons to defend themselves if there's a threat, to an actual threat that happens to their security with respect to that, and they intend to use them. So what an American victory looks like, or the outcome, is either they accomplish regime change, or there's a new art form around the world on the order of what they call Hiroshima shadows, only in cities across the United States and Europe and all over the world, okay. Which is too horrible to imagine, but is very close to happening.
30 seconds to you, offer desires in conclusion. This is a world conflict now. You have shortages of energy. You have shortages of food. You have the IMF sounding off the alarm in Africa in terms of food insecurity, that there'll be social unrest. Countries around the world are suffering from either wheat, energy I mentioned, inflation, recession. Isn't this madness?
It is total madness, and it was predictable, and it was preventable, because the proposals that Putin put on the table in December, which I read, were entirely moderate. And all he wanted was an European security architecture that would protect the rights of everybody, including Ukrainians and Russians. But the Americans didn't want that.
Okay.
I mean, it's been on our agenda change in Russia.
Thank you for that. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. That was Alfred Dezayas, lawyer, writer, historian, and former U.N. Special Rapporteur. Don DeBar, thank you so much. Activist and commentator from Westchester, New York. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spot.